Psalm 35, a psalm of David. Contend, O Lord, with those who contend with me. Fight against those who fight against me. Take hold of shield and buckler and rise for my help. Draw the spear and javelin against my pursuers. Say to my soul, I am your salvation. Let them be put to shame and dishonor who seek after my life. Let them be turned back and disappointed, who devise evil against me. Let them be like chaff before the wind, with the angel of the Lord driving them away. Let their way be dark and slippery, with the angel of the Lord pursuing them. For without cause they hid their net for me. Without cause they dug a pit for my life. Let destruction come upon him when he does not know it, and let the net that he hid ensnare him. Let him fall into it, to his destruction. Then my soul will rejoice in the Lord, exulting in his salvation. All my bones shall say, O Lord, who is like you, delivering the poor from him who is too strong for him, the poor and needy from him who robs him? Malicious witnesses rise up. They ask of me things that I do not know. They repay me evil for good. My soul is bereft. But I, when they were sick, I wore sackcloth. I afflicted myself with fasting. I prayed with my head bowed on my chest. I went about as though I grieved for my friend or my brother. As one who laments his mother, I bowed down in mourning. But at my stumbling, they rejoiced and gathered. They gathered together against me. Wretches whom I did not know tore at me without ceasing. Like profane mockers at a feast, they gnash at me with their teeth. How long, O Lord, will you look on? Rescue me from their destruction, my precious life from the lions. I will thank you in the great congregation. In the mighty throng, I will praise you. Let not those rejoice over me who are wrongfully my foes. And let not those wink the eye who hate me without cause. For they do not speak peace, but against those who are quiet in the land, they devise words of deceit. They open wide their mouths against me. They say, aha, aha, our eyes have seen it. You have seen, O Lord, be not silent. O Lord, be not far from me. Awake and rouse yourself for my vindication, for my cause, my God and my Lord. Vindicate me, O Lord, my God, according to your righteousness, and let them not rejoice over me. Let them not say in their hearts, aha, our heart's desire. Let them not say, we have swallowed him up. Let them be put to shame and disappointed altogether, who rejoice at my calamity. Let them be clothed with shame and dishonor, who magnify themselves against me. Let those who delight in my righteousness shout for joy and be glad, and say evermore, great is the Lord, who delights in the welfare of his servant. Then my tongue shall tell of your righteousness and of your praise all the day long.
So we are looking at Numbers, the book of Numbers, and we're going to be starting with Numbers 5. I'm excited to dive into this with you, and we're going to try to kind of jump very quickly right into it. So for a little context, the Israelites are by Mount Sinai and preparing to march through the wilderness to the promised land as the Lord leads. There's been a census, and the Lord has given instructions for how the camp is to be arranged around the tabernacle, and he's given instructions on the Levites on how they're supposed to take care and transport the tabernacle. And so join me, if you will, in Numbers 5, right here. I'll just get my notes there. All right. So if you recall in Leviticus, we were talking about quite a bit of discussion about in the law codes for distinctions between clean and unclean, with an emphasis on God's holiness and the need for holiness in order for his people to be in his presence, God's holy presence. And here, right here at the start of this, there's going to be a removal of the unclean from the immediate Israelite camp. So we'll dive right into it. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, command the people of Israel that they put out of the camp everyone who is leprous or has a discharge and everyone who is unclean through contact with the dead. Because if you recall, touching a dead body was something that you would become unclean. It would not be appropriate for you to be in the camp or approaching the temple and remember, or the tabernacle. And remember, the big thing coming back to again and again is that if the Israelites defile the place of God's presence where there is holiness, right? God said that there would be consequences of that. At one point, he says like he wasn't going to go with the Israelites because if they were in his presence with their undealt with sin, their uncleanness, right? That there was going to be their moral uncleanness in that context, that they would actually be killed, they would be destroyed. So this is very serious. You shall put out both male and female, putting them outside the camp, that they may not defile their camp in the midst of which I dwell. So you don't want to defile that camp. And the people of Israel did so and put them outside the camp as the Lord said to Moses, so the people of Israel did. So here we see there's talking about leprous, and we talked about leprosy in the past. You can always go back on the website and listen to some of the teachings in Leviticus if you have questions about that. We talked to how that phrase doesn't just seem to not referring directly to modern-day leprosy, but a broader variety of skin diseases. And we talked about even just thinking about, remember, this is the God of the universe. It's mind-boggling. The God of the universe dwelling in the camp. He delights to be with his people. And as a father shows compassion to his children, so he shows compassion to those who fear him. He is giving them instructions so that they can be in his presence. And there is a removal. He's asking them to remove people who are in a state of uncleanness. It's actually for the Israelites' good. It's even for those people's good. And again, throughout the Pentateuch, we're going to see these ideas of clean and unclean, holy and unholy, emphasized again and again and again. And I want to point out, sometimes Josh has spoken about this, we can read in concepts, read in ideas in the Bible that aren't actually there. And here, those people are being removed. It doesn't say they're being punished or rejected by the Lord. Nor that their states were permanent necessarily, right? And Leviticus actually gives a specific code, a means for cleansing and reincorporation into the camp for people who are able to be reincorporated into the camp. Something else that's interesting here is if you think of God's presence is in the Holy of Holies, which we'll talk a little about more later on. But if you think he's there in the tent of meeting, right, the tabernacle, and it's surrounded by Moses and the Levites, and then surrounding that is the rest of the tribes of Israel in that camp, and then outside, removed here, right, put out of the camp on the outer area are people in states of uncleanness. So if you think of it as like kind of concentric circles around the presence of God, the Holy One of the universe. And also worth noting that I think it's interesting to note, they aren't being cast out of the nation. There are things which people do which says like they're going to be cut off from the people, sinful things, rebellious things. These people are not being cast out of the nation. They're still part of the nation. They're not cut off, but there is a distinction being made between clean and unclean, and that's important, the idea of holiness and to be set apart. So we'll keep going. Now you can think of the following, the rest of the passages in this chapter, if you kind of think about it as like, first we're given this picture of cleanliness and people being removed outside the camp, and now there's going to be a picture what I think contextually is talking about how we're supposed to treat one another, the kind of people God's people are to be within the camp. So we'll read that from verse 5 through 10, and then we're going to see an even more intimate picture after that of how people are, I think in a sense you can think about how people are supposed to treat one another within a family, specifically within a family like marriage dynamic. So we'll go forward here. And the Lord spoke to Moses saying, speak to the people of Israel, when a man or woman commits any of the sins that people commit by breaking faith with the Lord, and that person realizes his guilt, he shall confess his sin that he has committed, and he shall make full restitution for his wrong, adding a fifth to it, and giving it to him to whom he did the wrong. So here, this happened actually, there's a discussion like this in Leviticus 6, The Lord told Moses, if anyone sins and commits a breach of faith against the Lord by deceiving his neighbor in a matter of deposit or security, or through robbery, or if he has oppressed his neighbor, or has found something lost and lied about it, swearing falsely, and any of all the things that people do and sin thereby, and then it gives instructions on if he has sinned and has realized his guilt, I will restore what he took by robbery, or what he got by oppression, or the deposit which he has commit that he was committed to him, or the lost thing that he found, or anything about which he has sworn falsely, he shall restore it in full and shall add a fifth to it and give it to him to whom it belongs on the day he realizes his guilt. And then there is a compensation. He goes to the priest, a sacrifice for a guilt offering. So that's in Leviticus 6, and something similar here is there's restitution plus 20%. And also we see this, there's a connection between people committing the idea of doing something wrong. Like, we can sometimes think, like, oh, if I did something wrong to my neighbor, that's not necessarily like, oh, but I'm still fine with God. But there's a connection, right, with the way we treat one another. If we wrong our neighbor, if we wrong our brother and sister, there is, God is actually, the way I think about it and the way the Bible gives it, God is always the primary party being offended, being wrong, being sinned against, even when we sin against other people, right? And so we can't do wrong to others and pretend we're right with God. To sin against neighbor is to sin against God. And so here, there's that restitution plus 20%. And, you know, now, what them as Christians think, when we sin, we should confess to God and seek to set things right with a person if at all possible. So here we see this, there's a restitution that's being made. But there's a question comes up, like, and specific kind of a specific instance which is going to, about to be addressed. But if the man has no next of kin to whom restitution may be made for the wrong, the restitution for wrong shall go to the Lord for the priest, in addition to the ram of atonement with which atonement is made for him. And every contribution, all the holy donations of the people of Israel, which they bring to the priest, shall be his. Each one shall keep his holy donations. Whatever anyone gives to the priest shall be his. So if you sin against somebody and you're going to try to make restitution to them, but you can't for some reason, it's not given why, the person seems like the person died and there's no next of kin, then you give it to the priest. But again, it's important that restitution is made. And then it's speaking about all the holy donations of the people of Israel, which they bring to the priest, shall be his. Because remember, God is providing for the priests through the offerings that people are bringing to the Lord, to the tabernacle. And all of this, just a reminder, like, for us as Christians, to repay no one evil for evil, but giving thought to what is honorable and seeking, if possible, as far as it depends on us, to live peaceably with all, which is talked about in Romans. So next, we're going to be talking about adultery. So already in Scripture, in Leviticus 20, it's laid out that, like, a man and woman caught in the act of adultery would face the death penalty. So it's clearly already, like, okay, this is a sin. This is not to happen. Here we're going to see a specific instance that's going to be dealt with. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to this people of Israel. If any man's wife goes astray and breaks faith with him, if a man lies with her sexually, and it is hidden from the eyes of her husband, and she is undetected, though she has defiled herself, and there's no witness against her, since she was not taken in the act. And if the spirit of jealousy comes over him and he is jealous of his wife who has defiled herself, or if the spirit of jealousy comes over him and he is jealous of his wife, though she has not defiled herself, then the man shall bring his wife to the priest and bring the offering required of her, a tenth of an ephah of barley flour. He shall pour no oil on it and put no frankincense on it, for it is a grain offering of jealousy, a grain offering of remembrance, bringing iniquity to remembrance. So, you know, I think throughout the Bible, adultery is treated as this great horror, right, in Old and New Testament. Marriage is, we're told actually later on, that in Ephesians, marriage is an image of Christ and the church. And so it's fitting that adultery is used as an image of spiritual treachery, of whoring after idols instead of the living God. And that word whoring, right, it's like a jarring word because it's so intense. But it is an appropriate word for the idea of, like, forsaking the living God and pursuing other gods that God uses. It's a simile that's used for talking about spiritual adultery, and God even uses the language of a betrayed husband calling his adulterous wife back when speaking to Israel about their spiritual sin. And, you know, it's interesting to me, in our culture right now, like, Adultery is certainly generally frowned upon in some ways, but also it's oftentimes romanticized. Like, think of movies and TV shows and books where it's presented not just as like something destructive that happens to be condemned, but there's also like it's presented in a way that feels like seductive, as like kind of forbidding fruit in this alluring way. And, you know, we can have an excuse that people kind of like, well, you know, when somebody's cheated upon or somebody's friend is cheated upon, it's a horrible thing that's condemned. Like, oh, how could they do that? That's absolutely terrible. But then when somebody, it's the person actually like chooses to have the affair, if that's your friend, the person who's actually doing the affair, sometimes there's this idea out there like, oh, well, the heart wants what it wants. And just kind of like, well, like, you know, things were tough, so it's not my ideal, but it's kind of excusable. And there's kind of a shrug about it. But that is one of the big lies of romanticism, I would say, and I mean romanticism in like the 18th, 19th century sense. This idea that our hearts are kind of like trustworthy, whatever our hearts kind of feel, are trustworthy navigation systems for right and wrong. And just history, and I think just grand history, and even just our own lives are evidence that is not true. I mean, for you, think of just a situation where your kind of heart felt one thing, and whether you did it or you didn't, you know that it was not giving you an accurate reading as to what would actually be wise or good or right in a situation, right? So that being said, adultery is like there's this horrifying sense, and there's even, think of the language here. If any man's wife goes astray and breaks faith with him, there's like a shattering of a faith, right? And a family. Now, in Deuteronomy, we're told that two or three witnesses is required for somebody to be put to death. On the evidence of two or three three witnesses, the one who is to die shall be put to death. A person shall not be put to death on the evidence of one witness. Okay? And in Deuteronomy also, it's said, like, if a man's found lying with the wife of another man, both of them shall die. Both the man and the woman. That there's no kind of double standard. Well, the man, boys will be boys, but the woman will die. Both of them will die. That's very clear. And right after it says, so you shall purge the evil from Israel. So the question is, that's being answered here, is like, what do you do when it seems like maybe adultery has happened, but there's no witness. Something that I think is honestly fascinating here is think of what a destructive force jealousy can be, right? We've talked about the destructive force of adultery, right? But what about the destructive force of jealousy and suspicion in a marriage or in a friendship, really in any kind of relationship, in a business relationship? Think of how, given left on our own devices, that kind of thing can ferment and turn poisonous and can lead to, like, somebody taking vengeful action against his wife or men he suspects may be her lovers. And here, the Lord is actually giving a means in which there's no apparent way to, like, authenticate what his suspicions are. The Lord is actually giving a means to put suspicions to rest. And it's not a means of mob justice. You know, you've heard kind of like, I have never looked into if this ever actually happened, but the idea of like medieval tests to find out if somebody's a witch. Well, we'll drown her. And if she survives, she's a witch because she survived. And if she doesn't survive, well, I guess she wasn't a witch, but we killed her, right? Here is a means of like figuring out, did something happen that is not painful, is not mob justice, is very sobering and serious, but is actually determinant of whether someone is guilty or not, and provides a means of exoneration and justification for the woman if the charge is cleared, if in fact she had not committed adultery. So what I think is especially fascinating to think about is what we're going to be given, what's going to follow, is God's supernatural solution to this situation. The law of the land in ancient Israel was inseparably connected to the transcendent God who was in their midst. And the Lord here gives a supernatural means, as you'll see. It is not just like, oh, it's like a purely judicial thing, or it's like, you look at it and be like, oh, this is like a common sense thing. It is something that if the Lord was not working, it wouldn't work. And the Lord is clearly saying he is going to work in this, a means of determining guilt or innocence in a difficult situation. You know, I think that's good for us to remember, the law of Israel or the moral code of Christianity, sometimes people talk about it, who do not believe in the Lord, right, will talk with admiration of the moral law in the Bible, rightly so, and that's a great thing that they recognize that, but it cannot be removed from the God who reveals this moral law. He's the God who wants to be intimately involved in their lives, not just giving like a law code that's like kind of good general advice, and he remains distant. But the whole point of the sacrificial system, of the law, is reconciliation so there can be relationship with God. And here we see just God intimately connected. So we're going to go into this. And, you know, in all of this, especially in passages that may feel like mysterious or unexpected or challenging, you know, I'm seeking to explain things to the best of my knowledge, right? But I just encourage you, coming in with just humility and open mind. And what we're going to see here, even there's like, I think, a sobering kind of horrifying consequence. So we'll jump right into it. And the priest shall bring her near, the woman in question, and set her before the Lord. And the priest shall take holy water in an earthenware vessel and take some of the dust that is on the floor of the tabernacle and put it into the water. And the priest shall set the woman before the Lord and unbind the hair of the woman's head and place in her hands the grain offering of remembrance, which is the grain offering of jealousy. And in his hand the priest shall have the water of bitterness that brings the curse. Then the priest shall make her take an oath, saying, if no man is laid with you, and if you have not turned aside to uncleanness while you are under your husband's authority, be free from this water of bitterness that brings the curse. But if you have gone astray, though you are under your husband's authority, and if you have defiled yourself, and some man other than your husband has lain with you, then let the priest make the woman take the oath of the curse and say to the woman, the Lord make you a curse and an oath among your people. When the Lord makes your thigh fall away and your body swell, may this water that brings the curse pass into your bowels and make your womb swell and your thigh fall away. And the woman shall say, amen, amen. Then the priest shall write these curses in a book and wash them off into the water of bitterness. And he shall make the woman drink the water of bitterness that brings a curse, and the water that brings a curse shall enter into her and cause bitter pain. Now note, he's writing the curses. It doesn't give us specifics on that, but says he's going to write them in a book and then wash them off into the water of the bitterness. And the priest shall take the grain offering of jealousy out of the woman's hand and shall wave the grain offering before the Lord and bring it to the altar. And the priest shall take a handful of the grain offering as its memorial portion and burn it on the altar, and afterward shall make the woman drink the water. And when he has made her drink the water, then if she has defiled herself and has broken faith with her husband, the water that brings a curse shall enter into her and cause bitter pain, and her womb shall swell, and her thigh shall fall away, and the woman shall become a curse among her people. But if the woman has not defiled herself and is clean, then she shall be free and shall conceive children. Now remember, of course, the importance, we've talked about this before, of conceiving children in that society, just the absolute, and in many societies continuing to. But in this specific instance, I think it's interesting that, one, the results of adultery, if indeed she was guilty, it's horrifying, right? And as I think something interesting is that if you think of adultery as like a dark inversion, like an evil parody of marriage, then this curse seems like a dark kind of inversion of what marital sex is supposed to lead to. The gift of life in the womb, right? Talks about in the womb in her. There's a swelling that happens here in terms of the curse, but it's a deathly swelling. It's a terrifying, bitter swelling, right? And even just like her thigh falling away, there's a sense in which I think this is supposed to be a reversal of sexual fertility, of fecundity, right? Like there's this inversion that's happening. A womb, in a sense, is swelling with guilt and judgment, and it's a picture of what is supposed to be sexually good rotting away. It's horrifying, and this is, I mean, a sobering passage, and it has something scary to say when people think they can mistreat others or spurn their spouses and still to pretend that they're like okay with God. There's very clearly a connection here with this sin and God's intimate involvement in the judgment of it, right? Now, this test for adultery, I think it's interesting to think of it. This is actually a way of also subduing a man's potentially dangerous jealousy. It's either going to reveal there's like an adulterous link. And I want to be clear, it's not saying the man who committed adultery with is excused from consequence necessarily, right? If that becomes known with, but in this instance, we're dealing with like, okay, there was no witnesses, what do we do in this situation? But it has this dual function if it's protecting an innocent wife from slander or a husband's unwarranted suspicion and jealousy. So we'll keep going. This is a law in cases of jealousy when a wife, though under her husband's authority, goes astray and defiles herself, or when the spirit of jealousy comes over a man and he is jealous of his wife. Then he shall set the woman before the Lord, and the priest shall carry out for her all this law the man shall be free from iniquity, but the woman shall bear her iniquity. That's the end, right? And you know, I recall hearing a writer say something about like a beautiful sunset can be reflected in like a broken bottle broken bottle in a ditch or something, right? Like in kind of a dirty place. And the sense of like, you can see, in something broken, you can actually see a reflection of something beautiful. And here in this, even in a chapter like that, which is quite sobering, there is actually a beautiful reflection in inversion, if you think of like what marriage is supposed to be. This beautiful thing where there is undefiled, unbetrayed trust. And it makes sense that all of us on some level know, oh, that's what marriage is supposed to be. It's supposed to be this good thing. Because as Ephesians 5 shows us, and I encourage you to go to kind of mentally make a note to go read Ephesians 5, marriage is supposed to be mutually serving, mutually loving, mutually nourishing, mutually trusting. The husband loving the wife as himself, all because it's a vision that reflects a relationship between Christ and his church. And married or single, that's a relationship we're all invited into. And that's the marriage, that's a relationship of which marriage is just a passing shadow. The ultimate relationship, trusting relationship between Christ and his church. Which God and Israel, as we're reading, is a precursor to, right? So, next we're going to be going to number 6. This is going to be talking about the Nazarite vow, you may have heard of. Nazarite vow. Most famously, Samson was under a Nazarite vow from the womb. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the people of Israel and say to them, when either a man or a woman makes a special vow, the vow of a Nazarite, to separate himself to the Lord, he shall separate himself from wine and strong drink. He shall drink no vinegar made from wine or strong drink, and shall not drink any juice of grapes or eat grapes, fresh or dried. All the days of his separation he shall eat nothing that is produced by the grapevine, not even the seeds or the skins." I'm going to pause right there, and one thing I want to bring up is that word Nazarite, that you might be wondering, what does that mean? The word Nazar is a word about consecrating oneself, separating oneself. So here we see this is a Nazarite, somebody who is consecrated, separated to the Lord for a certain period of time. Though Samson was somebody who was consecrated from the womb for his whole life. It's cool. It's a voluntary vow. It is open to men and women for a specific period of time. And there's similar language that's used of John the Baptist and Samuel. And it's also been suggested that Anna in Luke 2, I never heard this before, who did not depart from the temple, worshiping with fasting and prayer night and day. It's been suggested that perhaps she took a Nazarite vow, or at least at some point. And if you recall, she saw Jesus when he was dedicated to the temple and was a great delight to her. So, Nazarite vow, and there's this separation. And it's not because, we see clearly, it's not because wine is evil, right? But there's a sense of being set apart and consecration for a specific period of time. But the biblical witness is not like, hey, wine is evil. Abuse of wine is evil. That is sin. But wine itself is not evil, right? So we'll keep going. All the days of his vow of separation, no razor shall touch his head. Until the time is completed for which he separates himself to the Lord, he shall be holy. He shall let the locks of his hair of hair of his head grow long. And even think if somebody's took a Nazarite vow and had this long hair, that would be just walking around the nation, the camp, there'd be this sense of like, oh, it's like a visual reminder. This person is set apart to the Lord for something specific. It's been suggested perhaps this was a vow just for extended worship. All the days that he separates himself to the Lord, he shall not go near a dead body, not even for his father or for his mother, for brother or sister, if they die, shall he make himself unclean, because his separation to God is on his head. All the days of his separation, he is holy to the Lord. And you know, this is resonant with something Jesus said, even just like that nobody is to come before the Lord in our relationship. Not, you know, my mom and dad right here, but respectfully, not mother or father, not husband or wife, not kids. Nobody comes before the Lord in terms of our relationship to him. We'll keep going. There's a specific, so we said all the days of his separation, he is holy to the Lord. And then we're going to be given a, for instance, like, okay, he's not supposed to handle or be around a dead body, but what if accidentally he's exposed? We're going to give, he or she is exposed. So we're about to be given what someone should do in that situation. And if any man dies very suddenly beside him and he defiles his consecrated head, then he shall shave his head on the day of his cleansing. On the seventh day he shall shave it. On the eighth day he shall bring two turtle doves or two pigeons to the priest, to the entrance of the tent of meeting, and the priest shall offer one for a sin offering and the other for a burnt offering, and make atonement for him, because he sinned by reason of the dead body. And he shall consecrate his head that same day, and separate himself to the Lord for the days of his separation, and bring a male lamb, a year old, for a guilt offering. But the previous period shall be void, because his separation was defiled. And this is the law for the Nazarite, when the time of his separation has been completed. So, just want to pause. That was what happens if somebody, if you're accidentally defiled, then we're given the instruction here. And now we're going to see how does this Nazarite vow come to an end? What does that look like? And this is the law for the Nazarite. When the time of his separation has been completed, he shall be brought to the entrance of the tent of meeting, and he shall bring his gift to the Lord, one male lamb a year old without blemish for a burnt offering, and one ewe lamb a year old without blemish as a sin offering, and one ram without blemish as a peace offering. Remember again and again, without blemish, this is supposed to be a pure, spotless, best of the herd kind of situation, and a basket of unleavened bread, loaves of fine flour mixed with oil, and unleavened wafers smeared with oil, and their grain offering and their drink offerings. And the priest shall bring them before the Lord and offer his sin offering and his burnt offering, and he shall offer the ram as a sacrifice of peace offering to the Lord with a basket of unleavened bread. The priest shall offer also its grain offering and its drink offering. And the Nazarite shall shave his consecrated head at the entrance of the tent of meeting, and shall take the hair from his consecrated head and put it on the fire that is under the sacrifice of the peace offering. And the priest shall take the shoulder of the ram when it is boiled, and one unleavened loaf out of the basket, and one unleavened wafer, and shall put them on the hands of the Nazarite after he has shaved the hair of his consecration. And the priest shall wave them for a wave offering before the Lord. They are a holy portion for the priest, together with the breast that is waved and the thigh that is contributed. And after that, the Nazarite may drink wine. This is the law of the Nazarite. But if he vows an offering to the Lord above his Nazarite vow, as he can afford, in exact accordance with the vow that he takes, then he shall do in addition to the law of the Nazarite. So clearly, the Nazarite vow was not something to be lightly entered into, right? The offerings are significant, and there's a great serious somberness to, like, hey, this is serious. This isn't like a vow you just kind of make just kind of flippantly and like, oh, I'll do such and such. It's like to be taken seriously. A vow to the Lord is to be taken seriously. You know, just for us, you know, there's a sense in which we are called to live consecrated lives, and that doesn't mean we don't have to, like, we're supposed to avoid shaving our head, right, or avoiding specific food or specific drink in that sense, but it means avoiding, we're called to avoid moral pollution and distraction from Jesus, to be wholeheartedly serving the Lord. And even when I was kind of talking about that sense of, like, oh man, like, putting the Lord first before other people, that is actually what enables us to love other people well and rightly, right? And, you know, this is quite a little side thing, but it's been, sometimes apparently people get confused that Jesus took a Nazarite vow, that Jesus was a Nazarite, because Nazarene, as in from the town of Nazareth, and Nazarite, people think, oh, that sounds kind of similar, but those are two very separate things, very separate things. There's no record of him taking a Nazarite vow. So with that, we're going to be going into a verse which is a famous and very beautiful blessing. We'll hop right into it. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to Aaron and his sons, saying, thus you shall bless the people of Israel. You shall say to them, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. So shall they put my name upon the people of Israel, and I will bless them. Which is beautiful, absolutely beautiful. And you even just think about putting my name, the holiness of God's name, and the fact that he has revealed his personal name, the Lord, right? Commonly understood to be Yahweh, that he has given that to his people to be known by. And this beautiful blessing, just, yeah, incredible. I was in a house yesterday and it was up on the wall, this particular blessing. And it's something that Aaron and his sons were supposed to say to the people of Israel in general, right? That's a great place to even just bookmark and look back at. And I love even just the if you think of the poetic power of it, that it start, each line gets longer as you go through it. The Lord bless you and keep you, first line. The second kind of line, the Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. And now the longest line, the Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. And give you peace. Beautiful. That word peace there is shalom, right? Give you peace, shalom. And shalom, as you may well have heard, is not just like the absence of conflict or the absence of war, right? Our nation right now is not necessarily like in a war, right? But would you say this is a nation right now, just if you look at, well, if you look at the news, right? Characterized as a nation by peace? I would say no. Of deep lasting peace, I would say no. That shalom peace is something more than that absence of conflict. It's a deep flourishing and connection to being in covenant with the Lord, knowing and having peace with the God of the universe. Knowing God is the only way to true and lasting shalom. And you know, I think it's a question for us as readers, as we read this, do you long for that peace? Do you know that peace? Do you see others around you longing for that peace? And we have it in covenant with our God. In connection there, we even see the Lord's personal name. So that is something to pray for ourselves, pray for our nation, pray for other people, right? It is in being his people, being stamped with his name of ownership that we experience that lasting shalom. So that being said, we're about to hop into the longest chapter in the Pentateuch. So we are going to go through this, but there's something I want to say beforehand. And I was curious, have you ever had something where your mind was stretched by something you didn't immediately get? And you know, I was thinking about, it might seem like a sidebar, but it does connect, about this a band I like called, or a project, I guess, a guy who puts out music under the name Manuel. And I really loved his music. And I remember driving, this is when I lived in LA, driving to Amoeba Music to get his new album. It may have been the day it came out. And I remember getting it and listening to it and popping it in, listening to it and driving, thinking, oh no, he's lost it. He's like lost the plot. And it sounded like, it's like electronic ambient music. I remember it sounded like a cheesy, like surf, 80s surf movie. To me, listening to it, it's like sound like the soundtrack to, like a bad soundtrack to Top Gun. And I thought, oh no, this is bad. Like this is, he lost it. He just kind of went off the deep end. But no, hey, respect to Top Gun. I wrote that before seeing your shirt. But as I listen more and more, I realized like, oh, he actually is doing something very intentional here. And the more I listened to it, the more I actually understood what he was doing, the more I was like, this is actually great. And it became my favorite album of his. And then it became one of my favorite albums, period. And so initially I was just like, oh man, he doesn't get it. But what I initially didn't understand, I stuck with it. And then I realized what he was doing and I realized how cool it was. And you know, I've had that experience with other pieces of art, pieces of literature. And I think that kind of thing is a testimony to, if you don't understand something at first, like holding up, like don't just give up, right? Keep an open mind. And you know, something I've talked often about in scripture is understanding, like approaching the text with humility and openness and not what C.S. Lewis calls a chronological snobbery, where like, oh, this isn't how I would write this now. Like, I reject this, you know, like, or like, this was a mistake, or like, this was repetitive, as if the people who write it didn't know what repetition was and didn't know that there are ways to compress a narrative effectively, right? But actually, keeping our minds open to like, oh, maybe something is happening here that is more than what we might expect. And here, that is very much what I think is happening. And as we kind of go into it, we'll talk more, but I wanted to have that in the back of your head as we're jumping into it. So something else about numbers that you'll see is there's sophistication in how time is treated, in how the timeline, the chronology is treated. So in Exodus 40, verse 2, it says, on the first day of the first month in the second year after the Exodus, right, post-Egypt, Moses is erecting the tabernacle. And then Numbers 1 started in the first day of the first month, the first day of the second month of the second year. And then Numbers 9, which we won't be getting to tonight, that's the first day of the first month of the second year. So you might be, this might be a little confusing to hear, right? Just when I'm repeating these numbers. But I think what's happening here, I think, is in chapter 7, I believe what most commentators take it as, is this is actually kind of like jumping back to that time, Exodus 42, around that time, and we're going to be given specifically offerings at the tabernacle's consecration. And I think what's happening here is it's kind of like we've been given this image. We started with the census at the start of Numbers, right? The census of Israel, which is kind of like a big zoomed out image of Israel. And then we learned about the tabernacle service of the Levites, the separation of the unclean, commands on holiness, including the Nazirite vow. And then we're moving to this grand dedication of the altar. So I think it's kind of setting the stage and then moving around in time a little bit, like when there's a film and there's a flashback, right, to give some key information before moving forward. I think that's what's happening here. But in any case, remember the Levites who would be in charge of serving the temple, of like moving, like gathering it up and once it's gathered up, of taking it and moving it whenever tabernacle. I'm going to do that sometimes because the tabernacle is eventually, there's going to be a temple constructed. But when the tabernacle and the Levites are transporting the tabernacle, right, carrying it, the Lord here is going to show, we're going to see that the Lord gave them what they needed to do so because there is some heavy lifting involved. So we'll jump right into it. On the day when Moses had finished setting up the tabernacle and had anointed and consecrated it with all its furnishings and had anointed and consecrated the altar with all its utensils, the chiefs of Israel, heads of their fathers' houses, who were the chiefs of the tribes, who were over those who were listed, approached and brought their offerings before the Lord, 6 wagons and 12 oxen, a wagon for every 2 of the chiefs and for each one an ox. They brought them before the tabernacle. Then the Lord said to Moses, accept these from them that they may be used in the service of the tent of meeting and give them to the Levites, to each man according to his service. So Moses took the wagons and the oxen and gave them to the Levites. 2 wagons and 4 oxen he gave to the sons of Gershon according to their service. And 4 wagons and 8 oxen he gave to the sons of Merari according to their service under the direction of Ithamar, the son of Aaron, the priest. But to the sons of Kohath he gave none, because they were charged with the service of the holy things that had to be carried on the shoulder. And the chiefs offered offerings for the dedication of the altar on the day it was anointed, and the chiefs offered their offering before the altar. And the Lord said to Moses, they shall offer their offerings, 1 chief each day, for the dedication of the altar. So before we go into the next sequence, just want to point out, so they have the oxen, they have things for carrying what they're going to be carrying. The Kohathites don't need ox and cattle because they're actually supposed to be carrying it. They don't need cattle and wagons. So because they're going to be carrying over their shoulder, which becomes important in 2 Samuel 6 up in the future, if you recall, when somebody grabbed put out a hand to stop the ark from falling, and God was angry at that. And we'll get to that when we get to it, right? But it was a violation of the way things were supposed to happen. So what follows here is really beautiful. I think, people can say it's repetitive, but I think, like I said, that's thinking about it wrongly, because I think there's actually supposed to be a ceremonial, beautiful quality that's reinforced by this evocative rhythm of repetition here. You know, to me, it feels regal. It brings to mind this great sense of the grandeur of the temple, the dedication of the tabernacle, and its primary place in Israelite life. It reminds me of a coronation, and a mere summary of something like does not have the same effect. The summary of the coronation of the king, it's just like, there was a, or a presidential inauguration. It's like, oh, what happened to the inauguration? Well, a guy got up and said a bunch of stuff, and I don't know, maybe there's music or something, and the president was there. That is so truncated and does not have does not give you the sense of pageantry or the sense of officiousness and the sense of heart swelling and that kind of thing for a presidential inauguration. I'm not making a political comment right now, I'm going to be very clear. But right, coronations or inaugurations or even just celebrations, right? You think of an anniversary celebration, right? Just truncating it doesn't give you the sense of it. And there is a way this could have been told in a compressed way, but I really think this is supposed to have this grand literary quality. So kind of, I think as I read it, I would recommend to you, think of the sense of atmosphere and the heart swelling and the excitement and the pride of each tribe is like, oh man, we're like, now it's the time that my tribe is bringing this offering. It's a beautiful thing. So with that, we are going to go right into it. It's about, this is 88, we're going to verse 88 in terms of just this specifically talking about the dedication offering. So again, there's this poetic flow, so listen with me, will you? He who offered his offering the first day was Nashon, the son of Aminadab, of the tribe of Judah. And his offering was 1 silver plate, whose weight was 130 shekels, 1 silver basin of 70 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour, mixed with oil for a grain offering, 1 golden dish of 10 shekels, full of incense, 1 bull from the herd, 1 ram, 1 male lamb a year old, for a burnt offering, 1 male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, 2 oxen, 5 rams, 5 male goats, and 5 male lambs a year old. This was the offering of Nashon, the son of Aminadab. On the second day, Nethaneel, the son of Zuar, the chief of Issachar, made an offering. He offered for his offering 1 silver plate, whose weight was 130 shekels, 1 silver basin of 70 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering. one golden dish of 10 shekels full of incense, one bull from the herd, one ram, one male lamb a year old for a burnt offering, one male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offering, 2 oxen, 5 rams, 5 male goats, and 5 male lambs a year old. This was the offering of Nethaneel, the son of Zuar. On the third day, Eliab, the son of Helon, the chief of the people of Zebulun, his offering was 1 silver plate whose weight was 130 shekels, 1 silver basin of 70 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, 1 golden dish of 10 shekels full of incense, 1 bull from the herd, 1 ram, 1 male lamb a year old for a burnt offering, 1 male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, 2 oxen, 5 rams, 5 male goats, and 5 male lambs a year old. This was the offering of Eliab, the son of Helon. On the fourth day, Elazar, the son of Shedeur, the chief of the people of Reuben, his offering was 1 silver plate whose weight was 130 shekels, 1 silver basin of 70 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, 1 golden dish of 10 shekels full of incense, 1 bull from the herd, 1 ram, 1 male lamb a year old for a burnt offering, 1 male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, 2 oxen, 5 rams, 5 male goats, and 5 male lambs a year old. This was the offering of Eleazar, the son of Shedeur. On the fifth day, Shelumiel, the son of Zerushaddai, the chief of the people of Simeon, his offering was 1 silver plate whose weight was 130 shekels, 1 silver basin of 70 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, 1 golden dish of 10 shekels full of incense, 1 bull from the herd, 1 ram, 1 male lamb a year old for a burnt offering, 1 male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, 2 oxen, 5 rams, 5 male goats, and 5 male lambs a year old. This was the offering of Shelumiel, the son of Zerushaddai. On the sixth day, Eliasaph, the son of Deuel, the chief of the people of Gad, his offering was 1 silver plate whose weight was 130 shekels, 1 silver basin of 70 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, 1 golden dish of 10 shekels full of incense, 1 bull from the herd, 1 ram, 1 male lamb for a year old for a burnt offering, 1 male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, 2 oxen, 5 rams, 5 male goats, and 5 male lambs a year old. This was the offering of Eliasaph, the son of Deuel. On the seventh day, Elishama, the son of Ammihud, the chief of the people of Ephraim, his offering was 1 silver plate whose weight was 130 shekels, 1 silver basin of 70 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, 1 golden dish of 10 shekels full of incense, 1 bull from the herd, 1 ram, 1 male lamb a year old for a burnt offering, 1 male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, 2 oxen, 5 ram, 5 male goats, and 5 male lambs a year old. This was the offering of Elishama, the son of Ammihud. Notice these different tribes we've seen earlier in the census, they're of different sizes, but they're all bringing the same offerings, all coming equally before the Lord. And each tribe is presenting a grain offering, a burnt offering, a sin offering, peace offerings, as detailed in Leviticus, right? And again, all of this sense of grace and forgiveness is needed to have a relationship with the Lord, and he has given the Israelites and given us now means, right, of atonement in order that we might have relationship with him. On the eighth day, Gamaliel, the son of Pedazur, the chief of the people of Manasseh, his offering was 1 silver plate whose weight was 130 shekels, 1 silver basin of 70 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, 1 golden dish of 10 shekels full of incense, 1 bull from the herd, 1 ram, 1 male lamb a year old for a burnt offering, 1 male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, 2 oxen, 5 rams, 5 male goats, and 5 male lambs a year old. This was the offering of Gamaliel, the son of Pedazur. On the ninth day, Abidan, the son of Gideoni, the chief of the people of Benjamin, his offering was 1 silver plate, whose weight was 130 shekels, 1 silver basin of 70 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, 1 golden dish of 10 shekels full of incense, 1 bull from the herd, 1 ram, 1 male lamb a year old for a burnt offering, 1 male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, 2 oxen, 5 rams, 5 male goats, and 5 male lambs a year old. This was the offering of Abidan, the son of Gideoni. On the tenth day, Ahiezer, the son of Amishadai, of the chief of the people of Dan. His offering was one silver plate whose weight was 130 shekels, one silver basin of 70 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, one golden dish of 10 shekels full of incense, one bull from the herd, one ram, one male lamb a year old for a burnt offering, one male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, two oxen, five rams, five male goats, and five male lambs a year old. This was the offering of Ahiezer, the son of Amishaddai. On the 11th day, Pagiel, the son of Okran, the chief of the people of Asher, his offering was one silver plate whose weight was 130 shekels, one silver basin of 70 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, one golden dish of 10 shekels full of incense, one bull from the herd, one ram, one male lamb a year old for a burnt offering, one male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, two oxen, five rams, five male goats, and five male lambs a year old. This was the offering of Pagiel, the son of Okran. On the 12th day, Ahira, the son of Enan, the chief of the people of Naphtali, his offering was one silver plate whose weight was 130 shekels, one silver basin of 70 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, one golden dish of 10 shekels full of incense, one bull from the herd, one ram, one male lamb a year old for a burnt offering, one male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, two oxen, five rams, five male goats, and five male lambs a year old. This was the offering of Ahira, the son of Enan. This was the dedication offering for the altar on the day when it was anointed from the chiefs of Israel. 12 silver plates, 12 silver basins, 12 golden dishes. Each silver plate weighing 130 shekels and each basin 70. All the silver of the vessels, 2,400 shekels according to the shekel of the sanctuary. The 12 golden dishes full of incense weighing 10 shekels apiece according to the shekel of the sanctuary. All the gold of the dishes being 120 shekels. All the cattle for the burnt offering, 12 bulls, 12 rams, 12 male lambs a year old with their grain offering, and 12 male goats for a sin offering. And all the cattle for the sacrifice of peace offerings, 24 bulls, the rams 60, the male goats 60, the male lambs a year old 60. This was a dedication offering for the altar after it was anointed. And something I love is that there's portions of scripture where it's almost like there's like a summary capping of what just happened. It feels to me like a beautiful design element within the narrative. And then lastly, in the last part of this chapter here, is after that is happening, we're going to see Moses going into the tent of meeting to speak with the Lord. Now, if you recall, in Exodus 25, God told Moses, speaking of the tabernacle, the Holy of Holies, from there I will meet you, and from above the mercy seat, from between the two cherubim that are on the Ark of the Testimony, I will speak with you about all that I will give you in commandment for the people of Israel. And later in Exodus 29, it talks about speaking with Moses in the tent of meeting. And so here, we're going to see that what God said would happen, indeed it did happen. And when Moses went into the tent of meeting to speak with the Lord, he heard the voice speaking to him from above the mercy seat that was on the Ark of the Testimony, from between the two cherubim, and it spoke to him. And there is a sense of great holiness surrounding that, thinking the voice of the God of the universe speaking from this inner sanctuary, the Holy of Holies, speaking to Moses. And if you recall, the cherubim, right, are the carved angels on the ark. And we've talked about this before, but the cherubim, remember the first time we encountered that was guarding the way to Eden, to the tree of life, after Adam and Eve's expulsion. And you know, the Bible is a profound and subtle document, and there are thematic and linguistic echoes throughout its entirety. It's incredible. The more you read, the more you realize there's all these connections, which is what you would expect for a document that is from the Lord of the universe, right? I even think of like, man, nature, our world, the animal and the human and the geologic elements of our world, they're also woven through with thematic echoes and resonances. And here, cherubim within the tabernacle in the Holy of Holies, I really think that is supposed to cue us to this is connecting back to Eden, right? To the tree of life, to the place of relationship we had with the Lord before the fall, a sinless place. And God is here giving his people a means of dealing with sin, a way back to him, back to that relationship. And I think we're supposed to see here that there's a progression from these offerings that are presented by these 12 tribes 2, here, this relational connection between God and his people, speaking to Moses things that are for the whole nation of Israel. Sin has been dealt with here, holiness is given, and now there is this connection with the God of the universe. And that, for us as Christians, that's a shape of the gospel. That's the same shape that we've been given access, direct access, instead of going through a merely human mediator like Moses, we actually have access through Jesus, who is the ultimate high priest, who is the ultimate mediator, who is God himself. We get direct access to the Lord through the atoning, once-for-all sacrifice of Christ. And with that, I think even as we're like, as we've been going through the Levites and the sense of the sacrifices they're bringing and what they're called to in terms of their service, it's just remembering, man, like God delights in obedience. Obedience is good. You know, I think sometimes people can tragically read the Old Testament through a law of seeing like, through a lens of seeing any law keeping as like bad or like, oh, it's just legalistic law keeping, right? But the law wasn't given to people so they could have a legalistic kind of relationship with God, like where they're not actually having true relationship, but rather it was given at that specific time so people could have access into a relationship with God. And seeking to honor God by living the way he wants it, that's a good thing. Thinking that you can keep the law and rely on your own works, that is clearly sinful, right? That is clearly like not the way of honoring God and having a relationship with the Lord. But for us today, like seeking to be obedient, knowing that we are justified by grace, justified by what Christ has done, think we are atoned for, that we have that free access, that should be something that excites us for like, oh, I get to serve the God of the universe. I get to be obedient as a thing that is like a delighting in my relationship with a loving father. Not like appeasing a distant distant landlord, but rather like, oh, this is someone I love. Just like in a marriage, like two people are seeking to honor one another and please one another, serve one another in a beautiful way. So like we're in this relationship with the Lord. And you know, if you're struggling with like the question of even just like purpose in your life, like we have been given the greatest purpose possible, right? Like these people here are the Levites and Aaron's sons are given this like incredible task to do business with the Lord of the universe. And we are given that task of serving the Lord, like each of us in this incredibly intimate way that is just, we've been given like, we read this and all of this should point us to like, wow, Christ has given me so much. I've been given so much freedom and from sin and anything that binds me, and so much great, just direct access to the Lord of the universe. What a gift. And I'm called to serve him. It's my joy, right? And invite people into that good news by spreading it, by inviting people in, right? We are, as 1 Peter says, we're a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. And we all have that, and that one, there's no longer sacrifices because Christ's sacrifice paid it all. And this is this beautiful gift we get. And so with that, I'm just going to close in prayer, but very glad to be with you all. And thank you for coming here just to go through numbers with me. It's wonderful. Lord, I just thank you for everybody here and for your word, and even just this sense of the beauty of approaching the holy God and having a relationship with him that we see here in this text, Lord, and thinking, wow, so much more have we been given in Christ, Lord, a once-for-all sacrifice where we don't have the priestly duties they did, but we have a different kind of invitation in being a priesthood. So, Lord, I pray that you would fill us with joy in that and even just see the beauty of obedience and delighting in who you are, Lord. And I just think of what an honor and even there's a somberness to it because it's approaching the holy God of the universe, but just a heart of delight and celebration that you are the God who delights to be with his people. I thank you for that, and that character is seen so clearly in the cross where you spilled your blood for each of us. And I just pray that even this week, there would be a sense of like waking up in the morning, I get to talk to the God of the universe. I get to talk freely with him because of what Jesus did. And Lord, that there would be an excitement that you would open doors for us to invite others into the sweetness of that relationship, the greatest relationship one could be in. So we thank you for that and for your goodness in Jesus' name. Amen.